This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by FRP Games, where overstock discounts range from 30 to 90% off. Noble Knight Games, where out of print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, this is Ari Marmel, author of Drell of the Underdark, Complete Champion, Complete Mage, and Forge of War. And you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 142. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I'm going to crawl into the mouth of a giant green devil face and hope it doesn't utterly obliterate me as we look at the 4th edition version of The Tomb of Horrors. And for this episode, I am joined by Samuel Dillon from RPG Musings. Welcome back to the show for your second appearance, sir.
Are you there?
Hello, how are you?
There you are. To start off with today, in this episode, we're going to chat a little bit about some news going on, and then we're going to review the 4th edition version of The Tomb of Horrors. I don't do news in every episode, but I try to squeeze it in here and there, and I think this is going to be a shorter episode, so I think it's a good place to chit-chat about a few things going on, both on the Vorpal Network, with my projects, and with some D&D things happening these days. So let's start off with a few bits of Tome news. Well, Tome-ish anyway. I'm going to talk about temporary hit points. That's the new project that I've started this summer. A website designed specifically for the 4th edition player. Not only do I have myself and contributors trying to bring you high-quality articles every single week, but I've also been scouring my contacts the last few weeks through the D&D industry to bring in some guest articles, and the first one has been sent to me, and by the time this comes out should probably be up on the website, and it is written by the creator of the Forgotten Realms, Ed Greenwood himself.
Wow, excellent.
So I hope people enjoy that, and I've had commitments and promises from several other industry insiders and some pretty big names that they're going to contribute some articles as well. So I'm pretty excited about that. I created a whole new category of article for the site called One-Shots and had artwork made for it and everything so that I can have the easy excuse to just sort of bring in guests every now and then to help the site get a good momentum as it's still young.
Excellent.
And Ed Greenwood is a good way to start. He's somebody who has a lot of gaming experience. He was writing for Dungeon & Dragon magazines way back in the first edition days, I want to say.
Yes, I believe so.
Back before there was a Forgotten Realms to anybody except him, the story goes that he had this whole world at home that he had been writing stories in, and so whenever he wrote articles for the magazines, he always set them in this world, and eventually the people at what was then TSR said, what is this world you keep writing about? And so he just started sending them boxes and boxes and boxes full of material, which eventually became the Forgotten Realms.
I think that's the ultimate goal of any aspiring RPG writer is to get your homebrew world turned into a giant campaign that's loved across the world, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And he certainly has lived that dream. And that won't be all you hear from Mr. Greenwood around here. I've also managed to pick up a advanced reader's copy of his new novel, Elminster Must Die, sent to me from the Wizards of the Coast Novel Department, which is the new Ed Greenwood novel coming out on August 3rd in hardback. That's August 3rd, 2010, for those of you time-traveling and listening to this from the future. And this examines the role of the famous or infamous, depending on your take, Elminster of Shatterdale and other former Chosen of Mistra, now that Mistra is dead in the fourth edition version of the Forgotten Realms. It's the first real exploration of Elminster in the fourth edition realms. And I gotta say, so far, I really like it. And I'm pretty close to the end, and I have an interview lined up later this week to record with Mr. Greenwood to go along with that episode. So you should hear that. That episode coming out before I take off for Gen Con here in a couple weeks.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to listening to that myself.
Are you much of a Realms fan?
You know, I'm not a huge Realms fan in terms of running games in the Realms. There's just so much, and I'm not the giant expert on it that I would feel like I needed to be to run in that world, but I do love the world. It was the first campaign box set that I ever bought was Forgotten Realms for second edition.
Cool. Yeah, and I think a lot of people feel similar, and I've heard and seen some things that make me believe that a lot more people read Realms novels. Between Greenwood and Salvatore with the Driss novels and that kind of stuff, I think a lot more people read the novels than actually play in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that.
So that'll be interesting for people to check out, I hope. I was really excited to get that preview copy. I was a little shocked. They told me they're going to send me an early copy, and I just figured, well, as soon as they get them in from the printers, they'll send me one. But what they sent me was... basically they had printed it off on their printer and put one of those stop by the office supply store and have them do a spiral binding on it and mail me that.
No kidding. So yeah. You have like a manuscript copy.
It's the actual galleys. Yeah.
Wow. Excellent.
So it's pretty cool. Be lugging that thing around the last several weeks reading it.
Making anyone that sees you that knows anything about Forgotten Realms very, very jealous.
Yeah.
Or skeptical, wondering if it's the real deal.
Yeah. Well, I even – as soon as I got it, I was so excited I started taking pictures and put them up on Twitter. So, in other news, let's talk about some things going on with D&D specifically, not just tome stuff going on. We're starting to get some previews of the D&D Essentials line. There's a new line of products coming out called D&D Essentials that are intended to help new players get into the game, as I understand the goal. But it's with all new material, and they're actually changing some of the focus and the philosophy behind designing classes and streamlining some rules and that kind of thing to make the game a little bit easier for people to pick up when they're just starting off. And some people have been crying foul. I've heard some more than one declaration of D&D 4.5, just like there was a 3.5 of third edition D&D.
Yes, as have I. Yeah, I've heard a lot of that, unfortunately, in all different media, on Twitter, on different forums for different websites, and my friends, some of my players wondering. Yeah, lots of conversation going on about the Essentials line.
Yeah. Now, what's your take then? Is this a 4.5 or is this something different?
Well, I am the eternal optimist maybe, but I am deciding to believe all of the people that I have a great deal of respect for at WotC, and when they write a preview type article and they say, look, I'm going to tell you straight out, this is not 4.5. I'm choosing to believe that. The fact of the matter is they've been making changes since the release of the first player's handbook in fourth edition. You know, they've been having pretty constant – or not constant, maybe that's the wrong word. But they've been having frequent updates. And for the most part, those updates are making the game better, not worse. So – I'm quite happy with their ability to be flexible with the way that the rules are evolving. And I don't necessarily think it's a 4.5. I don't know what it's going to do to the game. I'm really looking forward to it. I think anything that can get new players into the game and make it very easy for them to grasp the role-playing aspects and the character-building aspects without having to grok the giant – player's handbook is a good deal. I think it's probably going to be great. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I have a similar sort of take on the whole thing as well. I know I kind of understand where people are coming from, because they've basically said we're completely changing the design philosophy of how we approach creating classes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're basically recreating a lot of the traditional classes, you know, giving them slightly different names. You know, there's the what is the new cleric that they showed, the Battle Priest.
Which
really looks like maybe a different build with a few different mechanics, but it's basically a cleric. And there is some potential for some confusion when crossing over between cleric and battle priest, I guess. But for the most part, it basically looks like a new build. It looks like an addition to what they're currently doing. And is it a signal of a new design philosophy for classes? Well, they say it is, so sure. But is that a huge deal? Because Monster Manual 2 and Monster Manual 3 both signaled a change in design philosophy for monsters.
Mm-hmm.
But is that 4.5? No.
It's way better. I think the Monster Manual 3 is probably the best Monster Manual that we have right now in this current edition. You know, when they say to the audience, to the customers, look, you can take this and think of it as just a different way to build a cleric, and someone can build this using their essentials set and walk into a room where there's an established group playing with Player's Handbook 1, you know, classes, and they can sit down at the table and play the exact same game with no changes whatsoever. That, to me, doesn't signify a new edition. What it signifies is new builds that were built or that were designed coming from a different perspective. That's all.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. I mean, I think, it like you're saying, it's basically it's an addition. It's not a change.
Mm-hmm.
It's adding to the game that we currently have. It's not completely changing the game we currently have. Because at the end of the day, everything we currently have is still valid. You know, they're not invalidating anything that we're playing with now.
That's right.
So ultimately, I think we're gonna have to wait and see what happens. I have emailed some folks over at WotC to see if they would, you know, be willing to share a little bit of what's going on with that. And I think they're busy putting out fires in other places, so they haven't responded to me.
Well, I think Rob Schwab, when he was on the Tome Show, I listened to it last week. He sort of said basically the same thing. Look, we're looking at it as a different build, and that's what they're telling their freelancers. So,
right. So I think it works pretty well. I do know that they did announce one pretty significant rules change that'll come with an update to the rules coming up,
mm-hmm.
Specifically with wizards.
Right. Yes.
Go ahead and tell us what that is.
That is the change that allows the magic missile to be an auto hit power. So there's no to hit roll with the magic missile anymore. And I think it changed the damage too, right? The damage went down to 2d4 plus intelligence modifier or something like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's sort of what happened recently. But it sounds like, as they've been discussing these preview articles for the mm-hmm. Essentials line, that there's more coming.
Right. They're going to give – I think every wizard build is going to have magic missile as a free power. But basically any wizard, that's sort of the mainstay power that if you're an arcana trained wizard, that's sort of the preeminent thing that you get. That's the first thing. I think in terms of design, I sort of think of it like, you know, when you go off to wizarding school, let's say, and you're with your mentor and you're just an acolyte and you're learning your first spells and whatnot, that's sort of the one that's the go-to spell to teach everyone. And if you can master that and do that well, then that's how you're you know, whoever's training you knows that, yes, you're ready to move on. So I think what they're doing is making it so that every wizard gets magic missile for free.
And I'm going to go you one step further, because I'm pretty sure I read this somewhere through the Essentials thing, where they're actually going to make significant changes to all of the wizard or most of the wizard encounter powers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, in
what way? What do you mean?
And it sounds like for similar reasons to why they changed Magic Missile, because Magic Missile was not broken.
Mm-hmm.
but they changed it to sort of capture the classic feel of the spell. As I understand it, they're going to add a miss effect for all the wizard encounter spells.
Oh, I missed that.
Uh-huh.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That's exciting. I'm interested to go look at that now.
Right. So the idea would be it would be more like the old school wizard spells, right? Where I would throw a fireball, and even if I miss, I do half damage. Or, you know, I throw a lightning bolt, and if I miss, I still do half damage. And so that gives a little more oomph to the wizard.
Yeah, that sounds good. I like it. I'm going to have to go check that out right as soon as we get off the phone here.
Hopefully I'm not making this up, but I'm pretty sure I read that somewhere. Or maybe I saw it from somebody on Twitter, but...
Well, we'll find out. I'll come back and tell you about it.
if I'm wrong... Go to the forums at vorpalnetwork.com and tell me that I'm wrong. And I will try to find the link where I could have sworn I heard that or read that. So,
hey, you know, that's a perfect way to get people to go to your forums and start a discussion.
No, I wouldn't do something like that, would I?
I know. That was without a preconceived notion, right? That just happened to come out of your mouth. Yeah.
Right. The other... another bit of news, I guess, to chit-chat about regarding what's going on over at the world of Wizards of the Coast is there's a new novel line.
Yes.
And it looks like they're doing a series of novels for the core world. They're calling it the core world novels, which I found interesting given that they worked hard early on in the fourth edition days to say that there is no core world.
Mm-hmm.
Now suddenly there's novels coming out in the core world, which means, of course, there is a core world.
Well, I think, to be honest, I think they really meant that when they said it at first. But, you know, then they put out the adventure series that started with Keep on the Shadowfell. And they have these things going on in the region that they're calling the Nintir Vale. And I think people really like it. And I think people are clamoring to get that expanded and to have it become sort of a quote-unquote real setting, you know. And I think they were working really hard at first to make things sort of setting neutral so that any dungeon master that wanted to run, an adventure could pull an adventure and put it in their own world without very much trouble whatsoever. So they wanted to stay away from having a named core world. But I think people really like what they've done with the Nintir Vale. And then there's the whole Chaos Scar thing in the Dungeon Magazine and all that. And I think it's a big hit. And I think they've decided maybe to expand it. And I'm actually happy about that. I like the products that they've been putting out.
All right. And so will you read the novels?
I don't know. It depends. Now you're going to get me to talk about canon. And, you know, the question is, then, are the novels going to be part of the core world canon? And I don't know the answer to whether I'll read those or not. It sort of depends.
Well, and I think that ties into some concerns or thoughts I have about the next topic, which is the Abyssal Plague, which is this interesting... I guess right now it's just an interesting event, but we don't know what that entails at this point. If you click on the link on the homepage for D&D on the Core Worlds link, it sends you to a page that halfway down says the Abyssal Plague. And talks about how there is a 5-part prelude novella showing up in various popular established novels, right? You know, the Ghost King book, paperback version of Ghost King by Ari Salvatore, The Mark of Narath, which is coming out from Bill Slavicek, which is a Core Worlds book, a Dark Sun book, another Forgotten Realms book, an Eberron book. All of these have these little parts of novellas leading up to the release of The Temple of Yellow Skulls in March of 2011. Which is, I guess, going to kick off this idea of the Abyssal Plague. But where it gets interesting is that it's being preluded in all of these books from different worlds. And it specifically, they specifically describe it as a world-spanning event.
Right, that's what I was going to say. Is isn't it meant to sort of bring all of the current campaign-setting worlds
a little bit closer together in terms of some sort of shared event.
Well, right, and that's one take on it, but ultimately we don't have much to work to go from. We know it's
right.
we know it's being previewed in a bunch of different world setting novels, and we know it's, you know, we know it's, it says it's a world spanning event.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean it's going to be an event that happens in Eberron and in the Forgotten Realms and, you know, in Dark Sun and in the core world, you know? And if it is, how's that going to work? And, you know, do I want that to happen?
Yeah. And I think also maybe they'll try to do it in a way that you could make it applicable to your own homebrew campaign as well. I think that because I think they'd be foolish to not do so. Because an awful lot of DMs run games in their own worlds, and they just pull things from all the other campaign worlds, so why not pull a piece of this as well? And I think they're smart enough to know that, and I think that they'll probably allow enough openness to be able to do that as well. I'm with you, though. I don't know if I really want that to happen, so
right.
we'll see.
I mean, on one hand, I look at this and I'm like, well, this could be really cool.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it could also be a little forced and unnatural and broken, you know?
Right.
Is it going to be something contained within the core world novels? Okay. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be supplemented with, you know, a campaign arc being released as adventures through Dungeon Magazine, sort of like they've done in the past?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did the – was it called Insurrection or something like that? Just before the WotC brought the magazines back in line during third edition,
mm-hmm.
With their company, when Paizo was still doing it, there was this big Gith storyline that happened over, you know, that was designed to be world spanning, and you could play it from any setting, and you know, big huge event, big poster maps and everything for it. It was really cool,
right?
You know,
right.
Something like that could be really cool, but at the same time, are you going to get your Eberron and Dark Sun into my Forgotten Realms?
Mm-hmm.
At which point I start getting a little hesitant.
And me as well. And then at that point, what happens, going back to the novel line, what happens to the future novels that we're going to write about, you know, well, not you and I, but that will be written about these campaign worlds?
Mm-hmm.
Is it all going to have been touched by this plague, world-spanning plague event? It's a question. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and for some settings, it's a bigger deal than others, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Eberron, they've specifically said none of the novels are canon, so it doesn't really matter.
Right,
it's just
right.
This, it's just this interesting story that you can tell in Eberron.
But in Forgotten Realms, the novels are canon, though, correct?
In the Forgotten Realms, everything's canon, which is
right.
Which, you know, that's different appeal to different worlds, right? Eberron, I like to tell stories in one way. In Forgotten Realms, when I tell Forgotten Realms stories, I like to embrace the canon. That's part of the point of the Forgotten Realms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so is it going to mess with that canon? And then Dark Sun has this odd thing where it has novels that are canon, but they keep you know, they're putting out the fourth edition Dark Sun, but it's back to the original before all the books happen. So you could change the canon if you want to.
Right, right.
So it'll be interesting to watch what happens. My guess is they're not going to say anything about it because they also haven't responded to my emails about that. So my guess is they're going to probably tell us more about that at Gen Con, since it's only a couple weeks away. And so when I go to Gen Con, I'll try to find out what's happening and get word out to you guys.
Yeah, I'm anticipating some big news at Gen Con. Just because I've gotten used to anticipating big news coming out of Gen Con. So I'm looking forward to hearing what it is. Unfortunately, I don't get to go this year. So,
you know, it's interesting. I feel like WotC hyped – since 4th edition was announced at Gen Con several mm-hmm. years back, every Gen Con since then, they've sort of had this buildup, you know, months of, you know, before, building up to what are we going to announce? What are we going to talk about? You know, last year we had been talking for months about they're going to announce a new setting. What's the new setting going to be? Everybody's
right.
Wants to know what the new setting. There were guesses and there were clues all over the place, and people were trying to figure out what the new setting is. They haven't done anything like that. I don't feel like this year. So I wonder if this Abyssal Plague thing is sort of their beginnings of trying to build some buzz. But I don't know. This doesn't feel like as big of a buzz as other stuff. Which on one hand. I miss the excitement. On the other hand, maybe that means they're being more transparent up front, and when they know something's going to be happening to the game, they let us know. You know, rather than hiding essentials from us and announcing it at Gen Con, they're letting us know mm-hmm. earlier on, you know, which is probably actually better.
Right, yeah. I would tend to agree with that. I think they're all very smart over there. I think they've made some marketing mistakes. They're not perfect. No one is. But I think they've gotten infinitely better at being transparent. They're still not 100% transparent, and I'm not sure they ever will be. But I tend to agree with you. I think it's more transparency, and that's sort of the trade-off to, you know, you don't get the hype if you're completely transparent all the time. So we'll see. What I'm thinking is at Gen Con, they're going to unveil a larger chunk of essentials that will sort of make people say, oh, okay. And then maybe they'll tie that plague, the world-spanning event, into the essentials release and try to make that have a lot of pow. And so everyone will feel like they're getting a big bang for their buck, and they'll run out and buy essentials.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I've sort of started gathering together some different portable recording equipment, so I'm ready to go to my first Gen Con. And I'll be recording as much of it as they'll let me, basically. And some of it, if it, you know, like the breaking news, the preview event of upcoming stuff, I'll try to release audio from that straight from the convention if I can. So people should look forward to that during the con. A lot of that will probably be largely unedited so that I can get it out as quickly as possible. So if you hear some different sound quality from the convention stuff, that's why that is. But I'm trying to get it out to you as quickly as I can. Other than that, I have a couple of other Gen Con things to talk about. First of all, like I said, I'm going to be there for my first Gen Con ever. I'll mostly be hanging out at the WOTC seminars. But you can also find me at the media meet and greet, which is designed to give all of the podcasters, bloggers, and audiences a chance to get together and say hi and hang out. That's Saturday at 8 p.m. at the convention, so hopefully I see a bunch of you there. Are you going to Gen Con?
Unfortunately, no. I don't get to go. I think next year will probably be my first Gen Con, believe it or not. I've been gaming for something like 28 years, and I've never been. It's never been within the realm of possibility for me. But
yeah, it's always been hard for me because they always have it like just as I'm going back to school as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So yep. I've never quite been able to make it. This year, Gen Con happens, and then I've got a week, and then I go back. So I can make it. There's I've been other like last year I could have made it as well, but I chose to go to Africa for a month instead.
Oh, how could you?
Right. So you know, there's always been something. You know, whenever I've had a chance, there's always been something come up. This year, I'm finally going to make it. So
excellent. Well, maybe we'll have to next year. We'll have to hang out.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully, of course, next year something, of course, will come up. And
right.
My school will decide to go year round or something, and suddenly I won't be able to.
Right.
We'll see. The other Gen Con thing going on every year at Gen Con, they hold the Innies, and the nominations for the Innies have been announced recently, and Vorpal Network has our newest member nominated in the category of Best Podcast. So make sure you go out there and vote for the Power Source. And likewise, I want to give a big congrats to Gamers Haven, one of the original Vorpal members, who got the honorable mention in the category of Best Podcast. So way to go, guys, and more people should be checking out Vorpal Network if we're putting out good stuff like that. All right. That was a lot of news.
Yes, it was.
But now it's time to go ahead and talk about what we came here for, the Tomb of Horrors. This is a classic D&D module, one of the first, in fact, written by co-creator of D&D, E. Gary Gygax himself. It featured the devilishly tricky puzzles and traps of the game's first Demi-Lich. And that Demi-Lich, Asarak, is back to his old ways and have sort of continued his schemes through second edition several years back with the return to the Tomb of Horrors, and is ready to go once again and put the world under his non-existent thumb in the 4th edition Tomb of Horrors. Before we get into that, however, it is time for our first sponsor, FRP Games, pick of the episode. FRP Games is an online retailer of gaming goodness with hefty discounts on overstock items. Overstike items? Overstock items?
Those are special items. Yeah.
The overstike ones are really special. So the pick for this episode is The Orcs of Stonefang Pass, another new adventure from Wizards of the Coast recently. And I'm going to let Sam go ahead and tell us about The Orcs of Stonefang Pass.
All right. Well, The Orcs of Stonefang Pass is module HS2, which means that it follows the Slaying Stone, which was module HS1. And it's a fun adventure designed to take a party of five PCs from 5th level through or to 6th level, and a little bit beyond 6th level, maybe. Basically, the story goes like this. What's left of an ancient dwarven clan has been chased into a deadly tunnel in their ancestral mountain home, and the Severed Hands Orc tribe is believed to be responsible for pushing them into that deadly place. Now, the party gets dispatched to investigate this dangerous mountain pass and to rescue the trapped dwarves. I don't want to say much more because there are a couple of different zingers in there that might be a little bit surprising, so I'm not going to do any spoilers, but I'll tell you that it's a well-written adventure. It's by Logan Bonner and Matthew Cernette, and it only has one prescribed skill challenge, but there is a situation about two-thirds or maybe three-quarters of the way into the adventure that opens up a wonderful opportunity for some great role-playing that can affect the outcome of this module in a very, very big way. It's full color. It weighs in at 32 pages, and it includes a large full-color map with one-inch scale squares for use with D&D minis. And, you know, I really like Logan Bonner's work, and I really loved The Slaying Stone. It's only slightly related to The Slaying Stone. Those that read through or played through The Slaying Stone will recognize the Severed Hands Orc tribe as the same orcs from The Slaying Stone module, but that's about the extent of how they're connected. The Slaying Stone was for first level characters, and this one's for fifth level characters. So this is something that you can throw into any campaign, whether or not you ran The Slaying Stone or not. It fits, and it's an entertaining story, and it has some surprises, and it has some really pretty nice encounters and some good role-playing opportunities. I recommend anybody pick this up.
All right. Sounds like fun. And that adventure is available through FRP Games for $12. Find links at thetomeshow.com.
FRP Games is an online retailer specializing in all aspects of your tabletop gaming needs. Whether it's RPGs, dice, war games, or computer games, FRP Games has a wide selection of products. They offer overstock items where you can pick up all kinds of gaming gear ranging from 30% off all the way up to 90% off the retail price. Through our website, you'll be directed to their weekly new products, eBay auctions, or you can even buy your special gaming someone a gift certificate. FRP Games is an authorized Wizards of the Coast retailer and for 10 years has been committed to providing each customer with the highest standard of customer service possible. Visit our website for instant access to FRP Games' inventory of thousands of unique gaming items.
And now it's time to talk about the 4th edition Tomb of Horrors. Now, they did some interesting things with this book. Normally we get these super adventures, right? And by normally, I mean, have we had one in 4th edition yet?
Yes, Revenge of the Giants.
Was that a hardback super adventure like this?
Yep, okay. Exactly.
So we've had one other hardback super adventure, and we've had them in 3rd edition like this, in a similar sort of style. And we had them back into 2nd edition as well, but only they were box sets back then, like the Return to the Tomb of Horrors was. So they did something a little bit different with the 4th edition Tomb of Horrors in terms of organization. Traditionally, these adventures, you know, start at a certain level and you play through to the end when the characters reach another, you know, level, and that's sort of the range of that adventure. That is not how this book works. This book basically gives you four shorter adventures that you run at 10th level, 14th level, 18th level, and then again at 22nd level. So you've got this story arc that they've given you that runs throughout your already established campaign and keeps bumping into it at certain levels, or you can make this the focus of the campaign and fill in the gaps in between that way as well. Did I describe that in a clear and concise way? Does that make sense?
Yes, that's exactly how I understand it to be. And in fact, the Revenge of the Giants, the first sort of, what is it, super module or super adventure, whatever they're calling them these days, for 4th edition, is actually not like that. So this is brand spanking new, the way that they're doing this.
Yeah, I've never seen something work this way before, through 3rd edition and 2nd edition as well. It's possible it happened, but I don't remember it happening.
Yeah, I don't either. I could have edition blindness, though, you know.
and I think there's advantages and disadvantages that come with this format. And on one hand, they give you the skeleton of a lot more story to tell, right? You know, they give you the high points and the basic – the key moments of a whole campaign arc that could run you, you know, through low or high heroic, even 10th level is still heroic, high heroic through early epic, and cover, you know, a good half of your whole campaign if you go from 1st to 30th.
I think part of the reason maybe that they did this, and I have mixed feelings about it, but I think part of the reason that they did it was – you know, if you run your party through the first set of encounters and the first sort of area, the first tomb, so to speak, it has, of course, as the Tomb of Horrors would be expected to have, lots of traps and tricky things to have to notice and, you know, puzzles and things like that. And, you know, I guess it gives you the opportunity, if you go through that and you find that your party just really isn't into that sort of thing, or maybe they're just not hardcore enough for the Tomb of Horrors in that way, then you don't have to finish it. You can finish that little area, and then you don't have to worry about the rest of the book.
Yeah.
So I guess it leaves it open. I would rather have a one cohesive thing, I think, but that's my own you know, preference.
Well, and I think this gives you a chance to do that. I mean, you can have one cohesive story from 10th to 22nd level, which you couldn't do in a super adventure before. I mean, there's no way they could do one adventure that covers 10th through 22nd level before.
True, very true.
So they give you the skeleton of doing a much bigger story. So that's good. The downside to that is that I'm not being handed something that I can just run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gives me some stuff I can just run, but in the in-between parts, I've got to continue to do all the prep and write the story and figure that stuff out in between. And they give you some tips and advice and some things to do throughout there.
But you're always, as a DM, left with having to, you know, sort of lead the players back into a situation right at the right moment for them to start the next portion of the Tomb of Horrors adventure, rather than having a continuous thing, you know.
Yeah, and they give sort of some, they give some stuff that you can do in between and that kind of stuff. But there is going to be some work that you have to do in between, and some prep that you have to do as a DM and some creative work you have to do. So I think I think this is an interesting way of telling the story. And I'll tell you now. When I started reading it, I put everything else aside, and this is all I read for a couple of days, and I read it cover to cover, and I really liked it. I really enjoyed it, and I'm using it in my campaign. You know, I liked it that much that I'm modifying some things, because I'm playing a game in the Forgotten Realms, and so I'm changing some gods and some stuff like that. But doing a few fairly simple cosmetic changes, it fits perfectly into my current campaign. I'm using it. I'm taking it almost whole cloth and just sticking it right into my game. And it's going to work perfectly for what I want to do and the story I want to tell.
I just started an online game yesterday, and I'm using it. So, right. So yeah, I kind of feel the same way. I was engrossed in it. I can't say I read the whole thing cover to cover because I did skip some different encounters and whatnot. But I basically read the meat of the book, and I really like it. I was impressed.
So let's, before we get into what we liked and what could have been better and that kind of stuff, let's chat about the legacy, because this is a story that has a lot of legacy.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, I've heard it described that the original Tomb of Horrors was the first modular adventure ever created for D&D. And so it goes way back to the beginning, and then it was recreated in a great box set called Return to the Tomb of Horrors by Bruce Cordell that came out, as I recall, just before 3rd edition.
I think so, yes. It was towards the tail end of 2nd.
Yeah, late 90s. And then it didn't see much play. It didn't see a conversion into third edition, which kind of makes sense because they had just done it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now it's back in the fourth edition version. So did you pick – how much experience do you have with sort of that legacy of the Tomb of Horrors?
I played through the original Tomb of Horrors as a player. This was before my DMing days. I was pretty young. And my brother and I ran through it with a group of our friends. So I remember dying many times in the old Tomb of Horrors with the green cover.
Uh-huh.
Back then, I was sort of a hack and slash player, so I wasn't necessarily picking up on the puzzles as quick as maybe I could have, or definitely than I would now. And I also wasn't as concerned with the backstory. Because the Return to the Tomb of Horrors came out at the end of second edition, I regrettably did not pick it up.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, as you said, there wasn't anything for third or 3.5. So I've touched on it, and I know the story, and I have fond memories of the original, fond memories of dying.
Right.
That's the extent of it. Yeah.
And I thought this book took a really interesting sort of, like, it honors the legacy.
You know, mm-hmm.
It doesn't say we're going to recreate the Tomb of Horrors. It's going to say no. The original Tomb of Horrors happened. The Return to the Tomb of Horrors happened, and we're mm-hmm. going to tell the story that happens after all of that. You know, and so you actually go back and visit locations from the original two adventures, and they sort of hide those little Easter eggs and things. And there are times when, you know, they even give a little advice to the DM, you know, at this point you're going into what was the original Tomb of Horrors.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like your players might remember it or think of it from the stories they've heard of the Tomb of Horrors, of legend from previous editions. But them thinking that it is good for you because they will be scared out of their heads, and that's fine. You know?
That's right. That's right.
That's without spoiling anything. That's sort of the advice, isn't it?
And they also, I mean, I got to tell you, one of the things that impressed me about it was the fact that they sort of pay homage to the history of it. And they say, you know, we're not changing any of that. This is staying here, and we're creating something new and hopefully just as good as what was there before. But they also go on to say, you know, if you don't think this is deadly enough because of the way that the mechanics in fourth edition are so different, here's some things to do to make it more deadly. But it's options, right? It's not here you have to do this because this is the way Tomb of Horrors is. It's here's what we're doing with Tomb of Horrors in fourth edition, and it's not like the others, but it's connected. Here's the legacy. You want to make it deadlier here, if you want to make it not as deadly here, and go have fun with it. And I think it's the exact right attitude.
Yeah, I think they approached it very well. In fact, Bruce Cordell wrote an epilogue in the back of the book at the very last mm-hmm. page, where he actually mentions that they took a real nod to the previous editions, which he wrote the second edition version.
Mm-hmm.
And so he liked, oh, look, he mentioned that and he mentioned that. And he even took things that were in like Dungeon and Dragon magazines.
Right.
You know, and
right.
pulled things out of that and made them part of the canon, you know?
And he also says, doesn't he, that if Gary was still alive, he would be writing this afterward and he would be just as pleased with this rendition.
And using much bigger words, I believe.
Right. Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Okay. So let's look at what we liked, what we didn't like, and see what else there is to chat about this.
Okay.
I mean, I think we've gushed over it quite a bit at this point.
Yeah.
Is there anything we haven't said that we like? Something else that you want to mention that we like about the book that we haven't mentioned yet?
Well, I remember the old Tomb of Horrors had the nice flip book with the pictures, and this one has the same sort of thing. It's a point of view picture to show the players while they're going through it, but it's in full color.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the art is fabulous, and the production value is just great. And I think it's a way to pay homage to the sort of past Tomb of Horrors, you know, episodes and. I really like that part, and I just want to mention it because I think they did it in a really nice way. It's very well formatted, and the art's really good. And you know, it's always really nice to show a player a picture of, you know, here's exactly what you see. What are you going to do?
Yeah. And
but it's not open. It's a page and it's not every encounter. So.
Right. And I think they also did a good job of capturing some of the original concept of having a lot of tricks and puzzles and traps and that kind of stuff. I mean, you go into one of the tombs and it's not all about killing a lot of monsters. Like, just like the original Tomb of Horrors was not about killing monsters. It was about can you survive through the puzzles and the traps to get to the what few monsters are in there. And it's it's the same way here. A lot of the encounters, you know, you're actually going to run through these tombs, I think, fairly quickly compared to a normal dungeon, because it's not you don't have to stop all the time and do encounters. Although how quickly are your players going to figure out puzzles? I don't know. And a lot of it you can boil down to giving them clues if they need it through skill checks and what have you. And I think that's they give some advice on that, and I think that's good. They embrace skill challenges more than I expected them to do. Now, I don't buy a lot of WotC adventures, so I don't know if that's normal for what they've been doing. But it seemed I was surprised with how many skill challenges they use, and I'm guessing that's because of the high number of puzzles and traps and that kind of thing.
I think there's two reasons. I think that's one of them, definitely, because I think this version of the Tomb of Horrors is a great deal about exploration. And exploration is not about combat necessarily, so how do you put a framework on exploration that makes sense? Well, you use a skill challenge. But I think that the other reason is that skill challenges, you know, they were pretty rough at the beginning of the release of 4th edition. And I think they're just now coming into their own. And I think that this is a great way to sort of get people to integrate them even more into their games. And to be honest, some of these puzzles were hard. I don't want to give any spoilers, but, you know, each of the main sections starts with a sort of a poem or a song, or the player sees something and can read the language and they can read a sort of poetic piece of work, and it gives clues as to what to do later on. But it's one of those instances, and here's a big hint for the players, pay attention to what it says in the poems, because that's going to help you go through. And that really lends itself well to skill challenges, doing something like that.
And it doesn't happen in every chapter, but I'd say – I think it was –
That's right.
The first
That's
one and the last one, there's something like that. And the last one isn't really – well, I won't – never mind.
Yeah, don't give it away.
But I think that this is also going to be a good transition for us to look at some of the things maybe I thought could have been better, because I like that they were using a lot of skill challenges. On the other hand, some of the skill challenges I think are going to get a little bit tiresome. Most of the skill challenges they did, I think, work well because they kept them short. You know, if I've got to make a total of 7 skill challenges and you give me 4 or 5 skills that I can use and this is how I can use them, great. That's a decently well-designed skill challenge. But when it's a skill challenge that needs 12 different die rolls and it's 3 different skills, okay.
Yeah,
That's going to get tiresome and turn into a grind pretty fast. And there's only so many ways as a DM I can sort of explain that. describe what's going on in a way that's engaging. When okay, you just made another insight check. It's your 4th one. I don't know what to say this time. You know.
Yeah, I have that same problem. That I think is a reflection of skill challenges coming into their own. I think that just like the combat rules in 4th edition are excellent and they've come into their own, and the use of powers really lends itself to the way that the game is played, but combat can get grindy sometimes. Well, I think the same thing is happening here with skill challenges. I think in their zeal to make it very puzzle-like and very trap-heavy, they've decided that skill challenges are the best way to deal with that in many, many situations. And sometimes, you know, you can just do one skill check and then let the players think their way through it without doing a whole skill challenge.
I think so, yeah. The other areas where there's really one other area where I thought there was some room for improvement. And I mentioned this on Twitter as I was reading it, that the cartography.
I was wondering if you were going to say cartography.
Yeah, the cartography in a few places fails in big ways. And somebody on Twitter responded to me. I don't remember who it was, but somebody on Twitter responded to me that it was a cartography fail.
Yeah. There is one major one that that I've heard whispers of people being very unhappy about. And it has to do with cartography, but it's the fact that the actual tomb, the original Tomb of Horrors portion that's in here is the wrong size. Because in the original, the squares were 10 feet across, and in this version, they've made them 5 feet across. Oh. So now the tomb is actually smaller than it was, physically speaking, which didn't make any of the old school people happy.
Yeah, that doesn't bother me at all. So
yeah.
My complaint is this. When the text and the descriptions don't match the cartography,
mm-hmm.
that bothers me bad. You know, when the description says the only way to go from this point to that point is to go down the pit trap indicated on the map with an X and and go through the secret door, and there is no pit trap marked, or when it says these ledges will fall apart and you use this hazard stat that we provided and you can use it whenever the characters stand on a square that's marked with an X and nothing is marked with an X.
Right.
Or there's one spot where In the last tomb, you've got all these different portals, right? And they're labeled on the map as to where they go, you know, which room they go to. One of them, you can't see which room it goes to because they put a token for a monster on top of it.
Nice. Like, yeah. I didn't catch that one in the last.
Me nuts. And it's all stuff that you can deal with, right? You can figure that out. You can leave the pit traps out, or you can just place them, you know, wherever makes sense to you, and you can get around that stuff. But that kind of stuff drives me pretty crazy. They did something similar in one of the last third edition adventures that drove me crazy, because it's like, okay, well, they go to this location. It's a house on the edge of a waterfall. But you look at the map, and there's no possible way for the characters to get there. Like, there's no bridge, there's no path, there's no, you know, what? How?
Right.
So I had to make something up, you know? Which, I want to be able to run stuff, you know, more or less straight as it's written, but you can't do that if it's not. And I think it was written well. I think that somewhere in the cartography and the map making, something fell apart, and it didn't happen.
Well, the problem is that it's in every section, because even in the very first section, when I first started reading the book, I was reading about the Garden of Graves, and it gives you a little overview, and it talks about the main areas on the overall map. And there were a couple of parts where it was a little bit confusing. I kept having to go back to the map and look and say, okay, now what are they talking about here? But then there's also one part that's not discussed at all. That I found, maybe I passed over it, but you come into this area and it says, oh, and you're going to go around here and you're probably going to run into this encounter. And so go to this encounter on page whatever. But they don't address the fact that there's a cave right there. And if I mention that cave, my players are going to say, well, let's go look at that cave. I don't want to keep going down the path yet. Let's see what's in the cave. Caves are exciting. Caves are interesting. I want to explore there.
Oh, you know what I think that might have been? Because I didn't run into that specific issue. Oh, no, you're right. There is that cave there.
Yeah.
they didn't mention the cave.
Nope, they don't mention the cave anywhere.
You're right. And the other area where I got a little confused when I first started going through that first chapter was that, you know, you read location one. Or where is it? No, it's location two, the cave entry. And it says go to G1 on this page, and you get to the section with the encounters, and G1 is not in order.
Right.
It goes G2, G3, and then G1. And it's, you know, it's fine. And oddly enough, they got the page references right. And I guess I can tell why they did it, because G2 is a two-page spread, G3 is a two-page spread, and then G1 is one page, and G4 is one page. So I'm sure that's why they did it, to save some pages. But it confused the heck out of me at first. So
yeah, I had to keep flipping back and forth with that. And the problem is that they do that in several places in the book. It's not just the first sort of when they were getting things together, and so the first chapter's like that. It's every chapter sort of has little tiny niggling things that annoy me. And like you said, it's just like the sizing of the tomb. It's not a game breaker. It's not going to kill my game. My players probably won't even notice. But it's one of those things that if there's enough of those little ones to build up, I start wondering why they didn't correct it before they released it, you know?
Right. Well, and I think like I've mentioned, the only thing that really chafes me is the mapping mistakes, because it's it's almost consistent with every chapter. There's at least one or two things that pops up that are pretty glaring.
Yeah.
And yeah, easy things to fix, but it bothers the heck out of me when, you know, if I can catch that in one read through, how many people there also read through this book before it went to print?
And why
didn't any of them catch it? You know, or maybe they did, and I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes if you're too close to a project, you know, you see what you're expecting to see, right. So you miss things. That's, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what. Anytime Wizards of the Coast wants to send me the book before they go to print, I would be happy to go through them and point out anything I notice.
I would be happy to also get a copy of that and come on this very show and talk about them.
All right. Other thoughts? Anything else you want to discuss? Good, bad, or just something that you think bears mentioning in the book?
Well, I thought it was interesting that they felt they needed to give a reason why a Sararak would leave all these traps behind in his tombs. I sort of chuckled at it, but then I realized, well, I sort of know why they did it. That's sort of a natural question to ask. So it's kind of funny that they did it, but I guess it's a good point. And the second thing is there's a connection to the Demi Lich Sararak in the Revenge of the Giants super module, super adventure.
Oh yeah.
If you have it, or if you ever pick it up, you can look at encounter 14 on page 76, and the party that's going through the Revenge of the Giants scenarios will run into a Sararak. So I thought that was sort of a neat little way to tie in. Now because of the timing differences and when Revenge of the Giants would have had to happen compared to when Tomb of Horrors has to happen, it won't probably be the same party of people, but it could be the same players depending on how you run your games. So that was a neat little thing. You know, they're making connections between – it's almost like an Easter egg, right? You make this connection from one book to another, and you don't have to notice the connection, or it doesn't have to be special, but it's just interesting, and I like when they do things like that.
Sure. I had one sort of other thought that I wanted to share, and I don't know – I didn't mention it before because I don't know if it's good or bad. Because it's one of those things where the book is telling me I have to do prep. And it's not just giving me the adventure to run. And that's one specific encounter where instead of giving you monster stats, it says, reference this page of the DMG and create your own monsters.
Oh, where's that at?
I guess I'll slightly spoil that then.
No, you don't have to.
It's a fairly minor thing. It's one of those sort of cliche encounters where the party encounters duplicates of themselves.
I did see that.
And so instead of giving me monsters that there's a couple of ways they could have handled that. They could have given me a handful of monsters and said, you know, flavor this so it sounds like them, but here's one for a defender, here's one for a striker, however you want to do it. Or they could do it the way they did it and say, here's how you create NPC stats for characters, stat out NPCs as your own PCs, and this is how you run the encounter, which is a decent amount of prep to ask a DM to do.
Yeah, I did see that. I didn't like that either.
I don't know if I don't like it, because I like doing encounters like that. And I think it's interesting that they did this in here.
Mm-hmm. I guess for me, I say I don't like it because if I'm running from a book, one of the reasons I'm doing that, there's usually two reasons. Number one is that I think it's really cool, which is what I think of the Tomb of Horrors. But the second one is it's less prep for me. And so anytime they throw something in there that makes it no longer less prep, it sort of rubs me the wrong way.
Sure.
But, you know, as I said, nothing I found in here is a deal breaker. Nothing here is going to make me not run it.
All right. Well, good. We've talked at length, much longer than I expected to, about this and the various news bits. But before we go any further, I want to talk about our second sponsor, Noble Knight Games. Not only can you sell your old books there, but you can also get out-of-print books there that other people have sold them. Or, in the case of my pick of the episode, you can get out-of-print box sets. My pick for this episode is the Return to the Tomb of Horrors box set by Bruce Cordell. It's a box detailing the tomb, the city that was created for this version of the tomb, around the tomb, the book of illustrations that was a legacy holdover from the original tomb, so you can show the pictures to your players, the handouts, and it comes with a reprinting of the original Tomb of Horrors as well. Now, this is a second edition box set, but it is a great source of inspiration for any edition of the game. And you can get that out-of-print, long out-of-print box set for $50, which is not too bad for something that hasn't been printed in 12 years and is very highly acclaimed. You can check it out through a link at thetomeshow.com.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more, Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, well, that has been episode 142. I want to thank our sponsors for the episode, FRP Games and Noble Knight Games. And, of course, I want to thank Samuel Dillon. Where can people find you, sir?
You can find me at rpgmusings.com, and you can also find me on the newly minted 4Geeks 4E podcast.
And where's that at?
That is at 4Geeks4E.com.
4Geeks4E.com.
Yes, the number 4 in both cases.
Fantastic. And you're also doing the DM Roundtable? Is that also
That's
on that
right.
site?
That is at dm-roundtable.com.
Okay.
Yes.
tell us a little bit about the two different the two podcasts and the website. What are they?
Well, my website, rpgmusings.com, I started as my own personal website a couple years ago, and then I started posting a lot, and I started reading a lot, and then I got busy and found I couldn't post as much as I wanted to, so I put out a call for contributors, and I have 4 very excellent contributors on there. So now when you go there, you get a plethora of different advice and points of view rather than just my own, so I encourage you to go see what's going on over there. And the two podcasts Sarah Dark Magic and Thaddeus and Wolf Samurai from Twitter and I are friends, and we decided to start a 4th edition focused podcast aimed at about 30 minutes with some production and editing and a specific topic for each episode for that. And the DM Roundtable podcast is meant to be an unedited, unproduced, pure recording of 4 or 5 experienced and, or I should say, of various experience levels, dungeon masters, sitting around talking about role-playing games in general, mostly 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons, but other things too, like the Dresden Files.
All right. Sounds good. And people should go ahead and check those out, and I will have them linked in the show notes.
Excellent.
You can also email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Visit the forums at vorpalnetwork.com, where you can tell me if I completely made up that bit about wizard encounter powers having miss effects. And make sure you spread the word about the show so the audience can grow. Gen Con's coming up, and I want to see if you guys are zealous enough to go out there and start telling people about the show all over Gen Con. And I think it would be fantastic if somebody came up to me or met me at a game or something and said, "Hey, have you heard about this thing called the Tome Show?" I think that would be a great introduction.
Hey, I'm going to put you on the hook, Jeff. Are you going to make t-shirts?
That's a good question.
If you make a t-shirt, I'll buy one. How about that? There's some incentive.
I sort of looked into the idea of making t-shirts today so that I could see if I could get something put together and actually wear it to Gen Con to make it easier to find me. Mm-hmm. And the sources I was looking at were going to be something like $25 to $30 a shirt.
Whew, ouch.
Which doesn't seem worth it. So,
well, for you, Jeff, I would still buy one.
I will. I'll keep exploring options, but I probably won't have anything before Gen Con.
All right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to the Vorpal Network forums, and I'm going to start a post. urging you to make t-shirts. How about that?
That'll be fantastic. That'll be great.
All right.
Other people can hop on there and share their opinion on the topic as well.
That's right.
All right. Don't forget to consider checking out things discussed on the show in the Tomes Amazon store. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Find links for things mentioned in the show notes, on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 142, where we slugged through the Feywild, the Shadowfell, a legendary tomb, and the realm of dead gods, all so that we could be confused about what was a door and what was a trap, leaving us naked and screaming as we run from the fourth edition Tomb of Horrors of
I'm on the wall.